If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56steve.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Vera Youngie is the volunteer coordinator of Unity Hospice and Palliative Care. Vera, this organization, when I heard about it, I said, we've got to talk to you on the radio because I've not heard about anything like this ever. And I've done a lot of radio interviews at this point. So tell me about what this organization is about.
Sure. Well, Unity Hospice and Palliative Care generally does the same thing as most hospice and palliative care organizations. We care for folks who are nearing the end of life with a 6 month or less prognosis and make sure that they have care at home, comfort care, symptom management, et cetera, so they can live their best life for as long as they have. We're different than other hospices, in my opinion, in that we are family owned. So healthcare generally right now is being bought out by larger corporations, private equity. Unity has been family owned for 30 plus years and intends to stay that way. So that's a little bit of difference. And one of the things that we do that I think is the most important is we have a foundation that helps patients with essentials, with last wishes. We help underserved patients who aren't able to get hospice care due to having no insurance, et cetera. So the goal of the foundation is to improve the quality of life and the memories for the patient and their family. And that's where our Pet Peace of Mind program comes in, which I think is what you're interested in.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to get to. And Dr. Jane Lomar, a longtime friend of mine, wrote me about this and said, this is what I am doing as a volunteer. So say again what the name of the program is and then explain what it does, because that everything up to here is fine. It's wonderful. It's important. Mm-hmm. But what you're about to talk about is what I've never heard of before. I think it's brilliant. So explain.
Sure. So part of that, like I said, improving quality of life and memories. We all know that our pets are part of our family, and hospice's main goal is to care for the patient and the family. And I think a lot of hospices don't include pets as part of that family unit, and that's our goal, is to make sure that they are part of it. So the Pet Peace of Mind program, we utilize volunteers to help pets in a variety of ways. If we have a patient who is bedbound, we will have somebody come over, feed their pets, change cat litter, walk a dog each day. We can help them get food at home if a family is low income and doesn't have the resources. We can even help with boarding or grooming if they aren't able to do that. If a patient gets hospitalized and are away from their pet for a few days, we can board the pet during that time. And I think one of the biggest goals, which the name of the program alludes to, Pet Peace of Mind, is making sure that when we know a patient is nearing the end, we start looking for a new home for the pet so that they understand my cat, my dog, my six guinea pigs are going somewhere that they'll be loved and cared for and not just, a random shelter.
Have you had a case where it was six guinea pigs?
We did, actually.
Wow.
We did have six guinea pigs offered. That one was before we had this program, and that was a tough one. Frankly, until now, the Pet Peace of Mind program has been the staff. I actually have a bonus cat whose patient sadly passed away, and so now I've got a extremely obese cat living in my home who is elderly and hilarious and snores loudly.
We'll be talking about pet obesity, actually, in the next segment with Dr. Ernie Ward.
No.
All right. So,
I should listen.
perhaps. All right. So here is something I want to talk about. You also, by providing care for the pet, you also then, the pet is still continuing to live with that person in hospice. And otherwise, without that, that pet may have to be given up.
Absolutely.
Aside from the animal's welfare, does the fact that someone who's coming to the end, that they can still live, and in many cases, there may be no family except that pet, the fact that the pet is still there to comfort them and to do what dogs and cats naturally do. Does that make a – is that kind of a medicine, actually, for those hospice patients?
Absolutely. I mean, hospice always focuses on both physical and emotional care. And we know that pets are one of the hugest ways to get emotional care. I mean, all of us, if you've had a pet and you're sick, you know they come and cuddle with you and keep you cozy. I mean, our patients, the way these pets respond to their illness is probably the most healing thing they can have in their life. And so us being able to make that possible, I think is a huge part of the care we can offer.
You know, at the end, and I've experienced this, and I'm sure many of you listening have as well, the person whose life is coming to an end may talk to you about whatever it is, mm-hmm. and want to do that, want to say, either reveal something or apologize for something, whatever. It's the last opportunity. Well, what if there is no family member to talk to? Do you find that people are actually tell their pets things?
You know, I guess I wouldn't know because we're not usually there with the pet, but they tell their volunteers things all the time. We have a lot of volunteers who are doing other roles, pet therapy, and then just companionship roles. And they're getting a lot of interesting revelations from patients pretty frequently because they come in without an agenda and they just want to spend time with somebody. And that person really feels that and often tells them things that they've never told anyone else.
I believe that. As far as the pets go, the person, so your mission, if I can articulate or try to articulate what I'm about to, your mission in part is to help relieve anxiety for people as the end comes. Do you think pets pick up on the fact that the end is coming for this best friend human being?
I mean, anecdotally, when I went to pick up my bonus cat Midnight, he had vomited all over the apartment. And that's not what he does. It was obvious that he knew something was wrong when his person was taken away in an ambulance. And it had only been a day, and he clearly was just concerned. And I think, yes, pets absolutely pick up on our mental states. That's why everyone loves them so much.
Yeah, in part that is true. When we come back, Vera, I want to talk about how folks can volunteer for, after all, you are the volunteer coordinator of Unity Hospice and Palliative Care for the pet portion of all of this. And we will do that when we come back on WGN. Vera Youngie is the volunteer coordinator for Unity Hospice and Palliative Care. We're talking about Unity's Pet Peace of Mind program. And I think, Vera, that is exactly the right name because we're talking about giving people peace of mind. I mean, there's so much that's got to be on the mind of a person who is in hospice. And worrying about their pet is not something, if you could take that worry away, and that might be one of the most significant worries. You know, there are stories of people that have waited for family members to come in from out of town before they pass, right? We've all heard those stories, and they may well be true. Having the pet there with that person, we talked a little about this, but that's got to be advantageous. And also, in a way, maybe, no science about what I'm about to ask, for the pet as well. Because if the pet were to have been removed, let's say, as that person goes into hospice, maybe 2 months before, the pet is just yanked away. One might argue that this way the pet can understand or get some understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, I like to think so. I think pets have a very unique way of sensing what's going on with their people.
So what do your volunteers do?
So some of the volunteers in this program are helping, like I said, to walk dogs, to feed cats, to feed the dog. Some of them are doing transportation.
Transportation in what way?
So we provide a crate and they can drive a dog or a cat to the vet to make sure that they can get updated vaccinations or just a regular veterinary checkup if they need that. they can transport them to the groomer and have grooming done if a pet is in bad shape in that way, or to a boarder if they need boarding while a patient is in the hospital or otherwise unable to care for their pet for a short time. So they can do all sorts of things. They could drop off food for a family if they need that. There's a whole host of ways they can intervene. And frankly, you know, some of our best volunteers take the pet role and the person role on too, because a lot of our patients are pretty lonely and can use some sort of side friendship. Somebody to shovel their driveway if it's snowing, or somebody to put down some salt, or just come in and say, hey, you want me to get your mail? You know, things like that.
Yeah. And to listen, I suppose, as well.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Our patients are going through probably the hardest thing they're going to go through.
Yeah.
And having somebody to talk to through that is a beautiful thing.
However, these volunteers don't have to have nursing skills or veterinary skills, I assume.
No. We do train them extensively on hospice and end of life and what to expect. And we do have to do some background checks and things, of course, because we're sending them to the home of a vulnerable person. But they don't need to have knowledge coming in the door. Our Pet Peace of Mind volunteers often do have a lot of knowledge about animals already, just because they love them. So as you mentioned, Jane Lomar, one of your veterinarian friends, is one of our volunteers. And
yeah,
that's the kind of skills we sometimes get in volunteers, which is amazing.
Well, yeah. She's certainly very skilled, being a veterinarian. But I want to make a point that you don't necessarily have to be. You obviously have to love animals, and it can be a wide variety of animals. So if I volunteer for you, am I going to just be with this one person until that person passes away? Or am I going to be maybe with two or three different people? Am I going there once a week, once a day? How does that work?
It really depends on the person. I try to work with our volunteers' availability. So some volunteers are willing to take on three assignments and they go to three different people. Some volunteers just have one person that they go to once a week or twice a week. We try to spread it out amongst volunteers and just work with what you have to give. So, honestly, usually my goal is to keep somebody assigned to the same person over and over, because that relationship building is a huge part of this, both with the animal and the patient.
Is it very, very difficult if the patient isn't all too responsive, which I'm sure happens? I'm talking about the human patient, but you're there for the dog or cat, which can be difficult on one hand because you've got a person not responding. And maybe there is a professional from the medical field administering to that person and or maybe family members. Is then part of your job just to distract and have fun with the dog or a cat?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our volunteers love walking dogs because it's fun, you know, and the dogs are always pretty cute and usually very friendly. We would never put a volunteer in danger, so we're not going to assign them to somebody who has an unfriendly dog. But, it's a chance to just bond with another animal who's probably a little bit lonely, too. They're not getting the same kind of care they were getting before. And so it's adding to their life also.
Or six guinea pigs, I suppose.
Or six guinea pigs. We heard about that one a little bit last minute. So I think one of our staff has six guinea pigs now.
All right. So let's talk about that. So the person ultimately is going to pass away. And when that happens, I presume you're there in part because there typically is no family member that will take the pet?
Yeah, usually, either the family members have made it very clear they just do not want this pet, or there isn't family members involved. Their power of attorney is a friend or something who isn't able to take a pet due to where they live. So that's often when we would step in for the adoption portion of things. But some of these folks have family and they just live in other states and they're saying, yeah, I'll come get the dog when I need to, but they're not there to do the daily care. So sometimes that's our role instead.
All right. So let's say there is no one else. Now, when you're volunteering, are you volunteering to ultimately become a foster for that animal? Or how does that work where that animal is ultimately placed?
Yeah, not necessarily. Our volunteers often do love animals and are sometimes willing to be a foster. But we partner with the Animal Care League in Oak Park, and they've offered to help us with their foster network also, in addition to many other resources, boarding, veterinarian services, things like that. So they're an incredible partner, and they've offered to share their foster network with us. And frankly, I know how to train human volunteers. I don't really know how to train fosters. I don't know how to train somebody to work with an animal, and they do. That's their area of expertise. So these partnerships are so essential for us to be able to run this program well.
However, it is not mandatory that you say, I'm going to help. And you do that, but say, you know what? I've got 3 cats and 4 dogs at home and 6 guinea pigs. So I can't I can't add anything to that. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's pretty common, actually. Most of our volunteers really love animals and therefore have a lot of animals. So we are not expecting them to be a foster unless they say, hey, that's something I'd love to add.
And I suppose at times that does happen because people fall in love with that animal over a course of time. So how can people volunteer?
So if somebody is interested in actually volunteering with this program, our website is unityhospice.com. If somebody's interested in learning more about Pet Peace of Mind specifically, this is funded through our foundation. So the UnityHospiceFoundation.org. UnityHospiceFoundation.org is the website you'd go to if you wanted to learn a little bit more about it, see what the Unity Hospice Foundation does, or even donate to the program. All of those can be done on that website. And but volunteering is on UnityHospice.com.
UnityHospice.com. That's if you want to volunteer. Just to learn more about it all, UnityHospiceFoundation.org. Vera, this is a wonderful and extremely important program. I'm surprised no one thought of this idea previously, but I am so glad you did. Vera Youngie, Volunteer Coordinator, Unity Hospice and Palliative Care, thank you so much. How fortunate was I to have the opportunity to sit down and interview Dr. Jane Goodall multiple times, the first of which was a telephone interview, actually, where we talked about her Roots and Shoots program. That was an interview that I did back for the Chicago Tribune. Well, that program meant everything to Dr. Goodall. It's about involving young kids. And by now, fast forward to today, Roots and Shoots is in something like 60 countries, has impacted thousands have enrolled in the program, and now their kids are in the program as well, which she is so incredibly proud of. But she was happy that I was the first, and always remembered I was the first to write, and for a major newspaper, about that program. So then she came to Chicago to speak at the Academy of Sciences at that time, and I sat down with her for an hour and 20 minutes or so. And that was for this radio station, for WGN Radio. And you can hear that interview. By the way, Dave Marzullo, thank you for somehow finding that interview. You can hear it at WGNRadio.com or my website, and that is stevedale.tv. Oh, we talked about so much. She had just been named a dame. That is something they do in the UK as an official something of honor. I don't know exactly what it means, but she was like, don't call me Dame. It was really quite funny. And we talked about all sorts of other things and a lot about dogs and cats and the impact that dogs and cats had on her growing up as a child. In fact, the dog she had growing up, she said, taught me that animals have real emotions. And of course, anyone who's ever had a dog or cat knows that that's the case. But at that time, way back when, scientists didn't attribute human emotions, quote-unquote, to animals, not even the chimpanzees. So she was considered controversial for just naming chimpanzees. She really was back then. Hard for us to imagine today. What's more, it's a woman doing this. Men did that kind of research, right? And she explains why Dr. Louis Leakey chose her and also Diane Fossey, who studied gorillas, that's the gorillas in the mist lady, and Birute Galdikas, who studied orangutans. Why did he choose women? Anyway, back to the dogs. She said, when I asked her, what animal most impresses you on the planet? And you'd think she'd say chimpanzee. She devoted her life to chimps, but she said no, it's dogs, because dogs offer unconditional love that no other animal, including our own species, does. You can hear it all at stevedale.tv. The Association of Pet Obesity Prevention, Dr. Ernie Ward, who is the president and founder. Good morning, Dr. Ward.
Hi, Steve. So great to be with you.
It's always good to talk to you, but I want to stop talking with you. And let me explain that. It's not that I don't love you, but I want to stop talking about overweight, obese pets. And it seems, I mean, we've been doing this back and forth for many years now, and it seems with each passing year, the reverse of what we want to have happen happens. There are more and more overweight or obese pets. Is that because more people are responding to your surveys? And we'll talk about that survey in a moment. Or is this a growing issue? Pardon my vernacular.
No pardon needed there. It is a growing issue, and we see this worldwide. You know, one of the things that's been really wonderful to watch is the global awareness and really response to pet obesity. And so now we started working with, you know, different organizations around the world, and we're seeing similar trends. And that really means more dogs and cats and rabbits and horses with obesity. And of course, that puts them at tremendous risk for a whole variety of diseases. But most importantly, it decreases their quality of life and longevity.
You know, you and I have talked about this, but I want to make an important point of this. It's not only their physical health, which it is. We cannot state that enough, I don't believe. But it's also their psychological health, Dr. Ward.
Oh, absolutely. And there's plenty of evidence to back that statement, Steve. I mean, you know, again, obviously we've looked at quality of life, and this just means a dog or cat's ability to ambulate, to eat, to play, to do the things that we associate with normal behavior. But more importantly, as we learn more and more about the pathophysiology or the harmful effects on our bodies and minds, we realize that, wow, this is affecting, as you mentioned, attitude. It causes depression in many people. You know, we certainly see a whole area of we don't call it food addiction anymore, but areas where you can't be satisfied. So, I mean, there's a lot to the behavioral component here, and this is why, you know, we often say this is not just a disease of the body, but as you mentioned, a disease of the mind.
All right, so let's talk about, first off, how many dogs and cats. And if you have data, you mentioned rabbits. We've not talked about that before. How many are overweight or obese in America?
Yeah, right. And we'll get to rabbits last. So at our latest nationwide prevalence survey, we found 61% of cats were classified as overweight or having obesity by their veterinarian, and about 59% of dogs. Now, if you dive into that number a little deeper, you find that about a third or 33% of cats were classified as having obesity, which of course puts them at the greatest risk, and a little over 20% of dogs. So again, when we look at the harmful effects of excess body fat and unhealthy body condition, cats are really at greatest risk. And of course, many of your listeners will be very familiar with diabetes in cats, which of course is directly related to obesity.
So if we did not have diabetes in cats, by the way, is I don't know. I don't know if you agree, but I'd almost call it an epidemic. So if that's the case, it's certainly common. And if that is the case, and it is, I think, if we did not have obese and overweight cats, we wouldn't see this. We wouldn't have diabetes in cats.
Right. To a large extent, that's true. There are a couple of very rare genetic mutations in cats that can cause diabetes without obesity, but you're looking at 99%+ of the cases or causes of obesity in cats is directly related to excess body fat. So, you know, we used to jokingly refer to diabetes in cats as a quote-unquote foodborne disease. By that, we just meant overfeeding and obesity, but obviously it's very complicated. But you're right, Steve, if we could wave a magic wand and eradicate obesity in cats, we would see almost no diabetes.
What about rabbits?
Great question. We don't have a very good idea yet on the prevalence of obesity in rabbits. And that's quite frankly because they're not very popular in the United States. They're much more popular in the UK, which is where we're starting to work with some organizations there. But by and large, you know, we are having all of our colleagues there as part of our reporting to say, hey, do you see rabbits? If so, is it a problem? And of course, the vast majority are saying yes. Now, obesity in rabbits is very damaging, very harmful. Again, rabbit physiology is vastly different than dogs and cats and horses, for that matter. And so, you know, again, when a rabbit is confronting obesity, really serious health consequences follow.
Yeah, and that's true for all of our companion animals, but I understand your point about rabbits. How does a nice veterinarian like you get involved with this topic that now, right, that now the entire world is being consumed by, sort of speak?
Well, you know, Steve, there's something to be said for persistence and being bullheaded. So when I started, you know, clinical practice over almost 35 years ago now, obviously I wasn't taught much about obesity because it really wasn't a problem back then. And then as I got into private practice and started owning clinics, I realized, wow, I'm seeing an awful lot of dogs and cats with obesity and then problems such as arthritis or diabetes or kidney and liver issues. I mean, the whole variety of problems. And at the same time, I was actually embarking on my own personal health journey. And, you know, I was very into ultra endurance athletics. I was an Ironman, doing all these types of different athletic events. And I was also, I became a certified personal trainer. So this is, you know, 25 years ago. And I'm sitting there seeing this abundance of research and evidence about obesity and diseases in humans and almost nothing in dogs and cats. And that was really sort of the genesis of it. I just said, look, is this a problem? And so in 2005, I founded the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. We conducted our first pilot prevalence survey in 2006, and then we did a nationwide study in 2007. And really, it was just to answer a simple question I had was, is this a problem? And unfortunately, it is, and we're still now working on solutions.
Yeah, and that problem has grown with every passing year. You were an Iron Man. I was a paper towel man. Is that about the same? Not exactly, I don't think. When we come back, I want to bust some myths. I mean, at some point in time, years ago, every veterinarian said the following: stop feeding too much table food and your pet will no longer be overweight or obese. It turns out, while that is good advice, that in of itself isn't going to solve the problem. We'll be back to explain all of that with Dr. Ernie Ward here on WGN. If there is a veterinary conference somewhere, anywhere on the planet, no doubt Dr. Ernie Ward is there, and he is and has been talking about overweight and obese pets. He is the founder of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. And there's a survey that you can participate in. We'll tell you about that in just a couple of minutes. And it's important to do that because veterinary professionals really need this information. But you also survey veterinary professionals. We'll talk about that. So when I had pets growing up, it was, if the pet is overweight or obese, it's your fault as the pet parent, because you're feeding too many treats. And what you said earlier was interesting, because when you were a young veterinarian, you said you didn't see a lot of overweight or obese pets. So why are we seeing so many today? And is it more complicated than you just feeding too many treats at the table?
Well, it is and it isn't. And I think that when we look at the history of obesity and the gradual increase, it parallels and mirrors that of human obesity. So I think that obviously changes in lifestyle, access to calorically dense foods and treats, if you will, those have all sort of tipped the scales in favor of obesity. Now, obviously, obesity is a multifactorial disease. That means there's not just one cause of it. So you can have a dog or cat, and you can literally maybe give them a little too much extra food and treats and table scraps and so forth. And that dog or cat may gain extra body fat, but they won't tip over into what we would call obesity or clinical obesity, a disease state. Now, this is why we now say, look, there's a combination of factors most likely going on in these dogs and cats with the disease, and that is genetics are going to play a factor, right? Alterations in physiology, spaying and neuter status, right? Exposure to environmental plastics, which we're hearing more and more about the harmful effects of, like, bisphenol A and other microplastics that you hear about in water and food supply. So, you know, Steve, it's a complex issue. The problem is, combined with lifestyle and access to high-calorie foods, we've just created a perfect storm.
All right. So if you, first of all, if you have an overweight or obese pet, it is you, my friend, who discovered that it's hard to see the forest from the trees. I'm not sure if that's a great analogy. But people can't identify. They're not even veterinary professionals for their own pets aren't great at identifying that their own pet is even overweight or obese. We all see our pets differently than what reality might be, Dr. Ward.
Yes, that's true. And that's one of the reasons why we encourage anyone listening today to go and take the survey and share it. It only takes a couple of minutes, but we do ask for your opinions on certain things, whether it's pet foods and body condition and so forth, and even some of the newer emerging solutions. And so, again, what we find is that there is this discordance or separation between the reality of a dog or cat's body condition and how the owner perceives it. And so in last year's survey, over 55% of dog and cat owners remarked, they stated that their dog or cat was at a healthy or ideal body condition. Well, that just doesn't marry with reality when we see 61% of cats and, you know, 59% of dogs being classified as overweight or having obesity by their vet. So you get, right now we know there's an issue. I will say there is a bit of a bright spot in this cloudy sky, and that is that cat owners seem to be doing better than dog owners at recognizing an unhealthy body condition. Now, this is primarily due to the uniformity. I mean, most cats, especially domestic cats, kind of have a similar shape and size. So I think people are starting to figure that out and say, oh, that cat looks a little heavy to me. But the reality is there's so many breeds of dogs that it's hard, as you mentioned, even for some veterinarians. And so we're working on some very interesting tools to try to help close that gap. But the first thing you can do is go to the website. We have a series of calculators and estimators and scales and different things you can use to try to determine your dog or cat's healthy body condition.
And also that survey. So what is the website?
Yeah. Yep. The easiest one is petobesityprevention.org.
That is easy. Petobesityprevention.org. All right, Dr. Ward, we have about 2.5-3 minutes or so left here. So in that time, so I have, let's say, an overweight or obese pet. Aside from cutting out too many table snacks, what else, what can people do about it? And soon, will there be Ozempic available or whatever those, I can't think of the name of all those drugs, but for our pets?
Yes, and I'll take the last question first, and that is, are GLP-1 RAs being studied or seeking approval for the FDA? And the answer is yes. In fact, several companies are working fervently on this, and so I do expect over the next 2 to 3 years, we'll probably see the first of those drugs emerge into a veterinary approval space. So again, hold on. We'll see how it all plays out. But so far, the early data, the early studies are promising. The second thing is, you really want to distinguish between, is your dog or cat overweight or has obesity? Because that's going to change the way I actually address them. And so if they just need to lose a couple of extra pounds, chances are we're going to work within your existing diet. We're going to count those calories a little more closely, maybe shift over to some lower calorie treats, maybe even go for an extra walk. But those kind of simple steps can make a big difference. But once your dog or cat has obesity, and again, we prefer the term now clinical obesity, which indicates a disease state is actually active. But now I'm going to say we're going to probably need to change some things. And the biggest change I'm going to most likely recommend is switching to a therapeutic weight loss diet. Because again, if we just cut the calories, Steve, we're also cutting all of the nutrients and vitamins and minerals that your dog or cat needs to stay healthy and have a strong immune system and be strong so they can play and enjoy life. So we're going to actually switch to a diet that's going to most likely have a higher protein, higher fiber, lower fat, moderate carbohydrates, but also essential fatty acids. They may add L-carnitine. I mean, we have a lot of tricks in at our disposal to try to help. But again, once they get into obesity, Steve, I'm going to say, let's talk about a therapeutic formulation instead of just cutting calories.
And how important is exercise, even for cats, in all this?
Yeah, well, cats are difficult because, again, different energy systems than humans and dogs. Humans and dogs, we use aerobic energy, so we're using fats that are stored as energy, and cats actually use a form of sugar called glucagon for their energy, so it's slightly different. But here's a cool tool we've got on the website at petobesityprevention.org. You take your dog's weight, you take how far you walked, you take how long it took you, and we'll tell you approximately how many calories your dog burned. And you're going to be a little disappointed, Steve, because that 40-pound dog going for a mile or two walk, probably only going to burn 30, 50, 60 calories. That's a treat, maybe, a couple of treats. So you can see always weight loss, healthy body condition begins at the dinner table or the food bowl.
Well, I suppose it's not too different for people. I go for a run and I come back and the app I have shows me how many calories, you know, I ran, you know, I really worked out, and it's like 60 calories. What? You know,
right.
So you have to do something about that. I hope you do. For more information and for these surveys, which are absolutely free to do, but you'll be helping veterinary medicine better understand what's going on here. Give me the website one more time.
PetObesityPrevention.org. And again, we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, you name it. We're just trying to get the word out. But that survey is really relied on by the vet industry to help provide you with the source, resources and tools you need.
Well, in fact, the pet food companies actually come to you now and they look at those surveys results as well, correct?
Yeah, and it's really starting to drive change and a lot of interest. And I will say that over the 20-year history of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, Steve, we've seen them now take this very seriously, and they are actively seeking ways to help.
Yeah, we're talking about pharma companies. We're talking about pet food companies. We're talking about veterinary professionals, individuals, or groups of veterinarians. And in part, Dr. Ernie Ward, you're responsible for that. Thank you.
Well, very small part, but again, this has just been one of those causes that I championed a long time ago, and I'm just so happy that people like you are willing to talk about it, because again, if there's one thing you can do to help your dog or cat live a happier, healthier, longer life, it's keeping them at a healthy body condition.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Well said, of course. Dr. Ernie Ward, thank you. So if you go see a comedy show in Houston at a club called The Secret Group, there's a sign as you enter saying, "No snakes allowed." Why is there a sign that says that? Because this guy came in with his pet ball python, and he left without the pet ball python. Now, months go by, and the people who work there think, oh, you know what, the snake just didn't survive. They did notice, however, that their rodent problem was no longer a problem. But no one sees the snake for months. But then one day, in the green room, a comedian sees something slither up a wall. And guess who that was? Well, it was the ball python. And the general manager felt badly that this guy left the snake behind. So he took the snake home. He renamed the snake Dolly Parton. Well, here you go again. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.